Winston Churchill had chosen the name Overlord, the code word for crossing the English Channel and breaching Adolf Hitler's Atlantic Wall. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you're going to hear from eyewitness participants in the largest military maneuver ever conducted. At dawn on the morning of 6 June 1944, D-Day, the weather was terrible. There were whitecaps in the wind-blown English Channel as more than 100,000 young American and British soldiers headed ashore in a high-risk effort to free France from Nazi domination. In this podcast, you'll hear from paratroopers who braved anti-aircraft fire to fling themselves out of aircraft on D-1 in hopes their comrades-in-arms coming across the beaches would reach them before Hitler's panzers could crush them on their drop zones. Listen carefully to the hair-raising exploits of the underwater demolition teams, the frogmen who swam ashore in a hair-raising effort to clear mines and obstacles. They were led by Lieutenant Commander Draper Kaufman, who was superintendent of the Naval Academy when I was a midshipman. You'll hear from Rangers who scaled the cliffs at Pointe au Hoc in an extraordinary feat of courage, skill, and tenacity. Eventually, 2 million brave Allied servicemen, including my dad, crossed the Normandy beaches to liberate Hitler's fortress Europe from Nazi domination. In this riveting episode of War Stories, you'll hear the firsthand accounts of remarkably brave men who slogged through water up to their necks while burdened down by more than 100 pounds of gear, paratroopers who dropped from the skies deep behind enemy lines, and Medal of Honor recipient Walt Ehlers, who led his troops off the bloody beaches into the teeth of enemy fire. If you're not moved by the voices of these remarkable men, nearly all of whom are now gone, you're suffering from an inspiration deficit disorder.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/war. That's ZipRecruiter.com/war. One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/war.
I'm Oliver North, and this is Omaha Beach, Normandy, France. It's peaceful enough today, but on the morning of June 6, 1944, it was teeming with young American boys, and those gray waters of the English Channel ran red with their blood. It was D-Day, the Allied invasion of France, and it was the biggest military operation in world history. Eventually, 2 million brave Allied servicemen would cross these beaches. Many of them were just teenagers. In this episode of War Stories, you'll hear from men who slogged through neck-deep water, weighed down by 100 pounds of gear, braving blistering enemy fire to reach this patch of sand. We'll hear from others who parachuted behind the enemy lines, dodging bullets and anti-aircraft fire as they fell. Those you won't hear from are the 29,000 more whose lives were taken from them to preserve America's freedoms and liberate Europe from Nazi domination. Almost 10,000 of them lie buried on that hill up here behind me. This, too, is their story.
We just didn't have any idea what we were going to face until we actually got there.
When we landed, it was just a shower of machine gun fire. They had every inch of that beach zeroed in for crossfire.
And as our ramps went down, I was the first one shot through the right side.
It was like a junkyard. There was equipment strewn all over the place. There were bodies and body parts.
They were getting slaughtered on Omaha Beach there.
We were scared. It was frightening, you know. We had never seen anything like that. We were only kids.
In 1939, Hitler had already begun his twisted dream of a Nazi empire by invading Poland. The following year, his troops swept into Denmark and Norway, then Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and France. By June of 1940, Germany had set its sights on Britain.
The Sky Battle of Britain and squadrons of Nazi warplanes swooped to the attack. A dogfight punctuated by anti-aircraft shells.
The Royal Air Force and the British people hung tough and repelled the Nazis, but Winston Churchill realized that air power alone couldn't beat Hitler.
Churchill realized that the only way Nazi Germany was going to be defeated was through a cross-channel invasion.
Planning started in early 1941, and by the end of the year, FDR joined Churchill in plotting a massive operation to liberate Europe. 21-year-old Army Private Walt Ehlers was part of the first Allied invasion of Nazi territory in North Africa, November 1942.
And I was so sick, I was hanging my head over the side, and these shells were coming out. It looked like, felt like they were just breezing our heads, you know.
Was your brother still with you?
Yes, we were together all the time.
Walt and his older brother Roland were farm boys from Kansas, raised during the Depression. Together in 1940, they joined the Army. But Walt, because of his age, had to get permission from his mother.
She said, "I'll sign on one condition." She says, "You promise to be a Christian soldier." And she told me that with tears in her eyes, and that kept me straight for the rest of my life, actually.
We had 15,000 men on the Queen Elizabeth.
Leonard Lamell was a 24-year-old Army Ranger from New Jersey. Little did he know he'd soon earn the Distinguished Service Cross for an act of extraordinary courage on D-Day. He was one of 2 million Allied troops heading for secret staging bases on the English coast.
Now, some of us were trained especially for special missions.
The day I landed, they kept talking about invading someplace. I didn't know where.
And none of the troops even knew the operation's code name, Overlord.
The conception and execution of Operation Overlord was the most complex and massive ever undertaken.
As the men trained, civilians on both sides of the Atlantic were feverishly producing thousands of tanks, planes, boats, ammunition, and other supplies needed for the invasion. Rationing and recycling were the order of the day.
This nation faces grave shortages, and this is one way of doing something about it. Here comes your family jalopy.
The contributions on all sides was incredible. There were 126 airfields constructed, almost 500 miles of railroad, and almost 1 million rail cars to shuffle cargo and equipment around the United Kingdom.
The GIs mixed easily with the British. Some even lived with them during their training.
People were really friendly there. They treated us like we were their heroes or something.
We liked the English people very much. We thought they were brave. We thought, my goodness, all the air raids they've taken, and hey, they got everybody working to win the war, whether you're old or young or kids or whatever. Everybody's doing their part over there.
Great people. Great people.
At 26, Art Van Cook of the Bronx was an old man on D-Day. He trained as an artillery officer near his base at Plymouth, England.
I was assigned to the 111th Field Artillery Battalion that gave close artillery support to the 116th Infantry.
The 116th was Tech Sergeant Angelo Monte Morano's unit.
The Germans came over and bombed almost every night.
Angelo, age 24, was from a big Italian family in Brooklyn.
We have five brothers in the service.
All of you in the service at the time?
Yes, sir.
What did your folks say?
They were very proud.
I was assigned to L Company of the 3rd Battalion of the 115th Infantry.
22-year-old Lieutenant Al Ungerleiter from Pennsylvania was a platoon leader at Plymouth.
I had 40 men under my control. They said, "We're going to give you an overstrength of 10. You'll have 50 men." So I said, "Fine." I figured they must think that we're going to have some casualties.
We trained in Wales and we trained in different parts of the Bristol Channel and the English Channel.
Alabama-born Jerry Markham was part of an elite Navy combat demolition unit.
This was taken after the unit was selected in Fort Pierce, Florida, as our training base.
His unit was the beginning of the special force that would become known as the Navy SEALs.
And over here is the famous Commander Kaufman, who is now known as the father of the SEALs because he originally organized this group.
He would hit the beach first and clear the way for the main landing force.
There was a tremendous effort on the part of the Germans to build bunkers for their heavy guns, to put all kinds of booby traps and devices into the sand, into potential landing sites.
The defenses looked something like this. Hidden underwater at high tide were 10-foot-tall steel structures called Belgian gates, with mines atop them. Then long poles with mines and structures called hedgehogs. Steel rails intended to rip open the hull of any landing craft. On shore, there was row after row of barbed wire. In between, landmines, almost 6 million of them. Then concrete pillboxes housing German machine and anti-tank guns. And on the high cliffs beyond were huge concrete bunkers protecting big guns that could rip through a tank or a ship. This was part of Hitler's famed Atlantic Wall, designed to crush any invasion of Europe.
An almost solid wall of steel and iron and guns and ruthless, determined men trained for generations in the art of death and destruction.
In January 44, Hitler put the man known as the Desert Fox, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, in charge of defending it.
His job was to repel an invasion. It was no secret that we were coming. The Germans knew that. What the Germans didn't know is when and where.
And the man in charge of keeping it that way was Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight Eisenhower.
General Eisenhower at his British headquarters checks the working out of plans. These are pictures of the striking force of American, British, and Canadians.
There were some guys, bad guys, that were trying to take away our freedom. We weren't going to let that happen. We knew why we were there.
Coming up, how the Allies chose this stretch of shore for their landings, and in one of the greatest deceptions in military history, how they kept that information a complete secret from the Germans. That's ahead on War Stories.
Along the coasts of Great Britain, the training went on. Navy and Coast Guard landing barges practiced landing operations day and night.
The challenge for the Allies was very straightforward. How to land approximately 150,000 troops from the air and the sea, and at the same time deceive the Germans as to when and where they were going to carry it out. And this was the key to probably the greatest deception operation in history.
It was called Operation Fortitude.
They created a fictitious army group in eastern England. They created fake trucks, fake boats, fake tanks. They made them out of wood. They made them out of rubber.
In essence, it was a ghost army. But to German reconnaissance pilots flying over England, it all looked perfectly real.
But what really sealed the deal was that they had radio operators sending phony message traffic, and every so often Patton would put an appearance in.
Old Blood and Guts and the Allies wanted to trick the Germans into believing his armored units would spearhead the invasion.
They thought we were going to come across at Calais, the narrowest point between England and France, and when we didn't, it was a surprise to them, and it was a surprise to us.
Now, what we were hoping for simply was to keep the Germans from reinforcing Normandy for a few days, a week. In the end, we deceived them all the way into August. So the operation succeeded beyond their wildest dreams.
There was no bigger secret than when or where the Allied troops would land.
We didn't know where it was going to happen.
Normandy had been chosen because it was less heavily defended than Calais, and field tests had shown that the sand on the beach could handle heavy equipment. In dead of night, Allied commandos jumped from planes or slipped ashore from mini-subs or boats to gather sand samples right under the Germans' noses. In the weeks before the invasion, American and British bombers pounded France, destroying railroads, bridges, and roads to cut off Nazi resupply lines.
12,000 Allied airmen gave their lives. 2,000 aircraft were lost. These numbers have never been matched.
The company commander called my brother and I, and he said, "You guys only have $5,000 insurance apiece." So he said, "We should raise that." So we did. And he says, "The second thing I got to tell you is that I got to transfer one of you out of the company."
By late May, Walt and his brother were separated. and the huge invasion force was quarantined behind fences, cut off from the outside world.
And that's the first time we saw a map of the beaches of Normandy.
I had this map sewn in my uniform and a little compass that I carried with me.
This map is printed on silk, isn't it?
Yes.
Eisenhower picked June 5th as the invasion date because it provided a full moon and low tide for the first landings. 2 days before, men from 12 countries and materiel were loaded into thousands of ships.
I never saw so many fields of tanks and jeeps and GI trucks and artillery pieces in my life, all lined up in the fields. Then we got into where the warehouses were. They were stacked just full of logistic equipment for the landing. And then we go down here, and here's all these LCIs lined up row after row, and you could walk from one ship to the other, you know, just without getting into the water.
It was just every imaginable ship you could think about.
But the one thing the Allies couldn't control was the weather, and it went from bad to worse.
Terrible. Stormy, rainy, windy. Just a miserable, cold day.
Soon after the ship set sail, their decks were awash in vomit.
We were sleeping on a steel deck. We were eating cold K-rations. No cover from the rain or weather.
Eisenhower was deeply concerned. And at 6 a.m. on June 4th, he put the largest military operation in history on hold.
But the weather here at Normandy was a blessing in disguise, and it led Field Marshal Rommel to make a major mistake. More on that, and the brave airborne troops who faced a sky full of lead as they dropped behind enemy lines just a few miles from right here. Don't go anywhere.
On June 4th, as the storm raged in the English Channel, General Eisenhower faced a momentous decision.
The decision whether to go ahead or not go ahead was left to Eisenhower. Based on that weather forecast, which in my opinion was the most important weather forecast in history.
The Royal Air Force chief meteorologist told him
that there was going to be a small window on June 6th. That the weather would clear sufficiently, that the winds would abate just enough.
At 9:45 p.m., after minutes of tense soul-searching, Eisenhower gave the order. It was go. Within hours, the convoys were forming up again in the roiling waters.
We didn't sleep very well that night. Everybody was smoking cigarettes like they were going out of style. Then over the loudspeaker on the ship, they read this greeting from General Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Across the channel, the Germans had no idea what was about to hit them.
The chief German weatherman was convinced that there was no way that the Allies would have mounted D-Day, any kind of invasion on June 6th.
They were so convinced that Rommel actually went home to Germany carrying a pair of new French shoes, a present for his wife's birthday, on June 6th.
We were going to jump behind the lines and seize our position and destroy the enemy.
Although just 18, Boston's Bob Murphy was a combat seasoned paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne.
All the Pathfinders had their photographs taken in front of their particular aircraft with their pilots and crew.
The Pathfinders were an elite force that dropped behind enemy lines well ahead of the main force.
We knew what our mission was, go in and bring the rest of the men in, and after the mission was over, blow up the radar and get rid of your lights and go back to your company.
They set up radio beacons and lights to guide the rest of the airborne in.
Everybody had all their equipment on them.
Weapons, ammunition, radios, and other gear increased their weight by up to 150 pounds.
When I jumped to Normandy, I probably had 100 pounds of equipment strapped to my body, so I weighed 250 pounds. And some of the men had more than that.
If you see some of the pictures when
the fellas trying to get into the C-47. There's a couple of fellas behind him pushing him into the plane.
20-year-old Vinnie Vaccari was an aide to 101st Airborne Division Commander General Anthony McAuliffe. This would be Vinnie's first combat jump.
We were all hyped up that we were finally going into combat, but there was always that fear. You prayed.
We knew about 5 or 6 o'clock that afternoon that we were going. Our battalion commander gave us a pep talk, said a prayer.
Dr. Bernard Ryan from upstate New York was a surgeon in the 101st.
Well, my mother was worried because I was the only child, and she was a widow. So she said, I think you've got to have your head examined for joining the paratroops.
Just after dark, as the main force prepared, Murphy and the other Pathfinders roared off the runway. The invasion was on.
It was clear weather, moonlight. We were very low. We had no fire in our entire area. And we parachuted and landed exactly on our designated drop zone, set up our equipment very fast, got it all set up, and sent out a signal.
Sky, if you looked up late on June 5th and early on June 6th, all you saw was the sky literally black with aircraft.
But there were big troubles awaiting the main airborne force.
We didn't know is that probably at 600 to 700 feet, there was a cloud bank. It was almost like flying into a fog.
Planes fell out of formation, lost contact with the Pathfinder's beacons, and became lost. And they were easily spotted by the Germans.
All hell broke loose. We're being thrown all around the plane while we're flying over this flak.
All I wanted to do was get out and get down to the ground.
There was the ground fire was so bad that I was pulling up my feet to dodge the tracer bullets coming up. I thought I was going to get killed right off the bat.
We were supposed to have been dropped in a 4-square-mile area, and we were scattered over 14 square miles.
It would take days for many of the men to find their units. But they were the lucky ones, because many of the drop zones had been flooded by the Germans.
Some of the fellows that jumped had as much as 150 pounds of equipment on them. And the ones that landed in these marshlands that had been reflooded didn't have a chance to get out. They just drowned them.
The men in the landing craft off this beach had no idea what was happening to those paratroopers. Next, the landings at H Hour on D-Day.
D-Day, June 6th, 0100. Navy warships at the head of the Allied Armada begin calling all hands to battle stations. 0200, 2 a.m. The first Allied bombers took off from bases in England to pound targets around the beachheads. Inland, British and American paratroopers who survived their harrowing jump began to accomplish their missions.
Such a hurry to get out of my chute that I pulled my trench knife and I cut my hands trying to get out of the chute.
They seized key bridges, roads, and towns to keep the Germans from advancing onto the beaches. But with enemy troops all around them, how could they identify friend or foe in the dark? It took a child's toy.
And they had given us these little clickers.
They made a click like some sort of an insect, you see.
If you heard someone, you clicked once. And if he was an American, he would click twice. And then as you moved, you gathered more and more people together and sort of formed a squad.
At 0300, more glider troops reinforced the paratroopers.
It was a very, very dangerous operation, but one that had to be carried out in order to ensure the success of Overlord.
Large and flimsy, the canvas and plywood gliders were towed by C-47 transports. Aboard, British and American troops, jeeps, and artillery.
When the gliders come into these fields and were cut loose in the dock, most of them crashed and killed a great number of people.
The gliders were just scattered all over the place. Even the British Horser gliders took a terrific beating, too.
Precisely at 3.09 a.m., German radar spotted the Allied fleet. The German commander ordered his shore batteries to prepare to repel an invasion.
At 4 o'clock, came over the intercom, a loudspeaker said, "And your boats, we're going ashore."
At 05:30, 1 hour before H hour, Allied bombers began their attacks. Moments later, the awesome firepower of the Allied naval armada was unleashed, dumping 5,000 shells in 35 minutes on the German positions.
We couldn't see because it was pitch dark, but it was, you know, we could hear the bombs, and it was like a big Mardi Gras, really. Shells exploding in the aircraft and the aircraft, and the big Navy guns pummeling the shore.
More than 70 destroyers and hundreds of other ships pummeled Nazi positions in the five landing beaches. Sword, Juno, and Gold were landing sites for the British and Canadians. The American 29th and 1st Infantry Divisions landed on Omaha Beach, and Utah was the target for the 4th Infantry Division.
You know, those shells were like 16-inch shells, and they come in like a freight train.
Art was aboard a 2.5-ton amphibious truck called a Duck. He launched from a transport ship into the churning waters several miles offshore.
The thing was weighted down almost to the gunnels, you know. There was a 105-ouncer with 14, 15 men, ammunition.
And within seconds, it began to sink.
We shouted for one of these other vehicles to give a hand, and an LCVP came in. We had land craft vehicle personnel, and we jumped from one to the other.
Art Van Cook's artillery unit was supposed to support the infantry, but 11 of his 12 howitzers went to the bottom in those ducks. Many men suffered the same fate in the pre-dawn darkness.
Could you see him at all?
The ones that went straight down, we could hear the kids screaming and yelling, but they were so weighted down, there was nothing you could do for them.
H hour was 6:30 a.m., dawn on Omaha and Utah beaches, and the blistering Navy fire lifted to let the troops cross the beach.
Of course, the whole thing changed the minute we come close to shore.
Jerry Markham's unit was one of the first in. They soon discovered that one of the fiercest naval and aerial bombardments in history had had little effect on the heavily fortified German positions.
Boats began to spray our landing craft, and we had two units completely wiped out with mortars, direct hits on their landing craft.
I still remember it landed right in the hood of the Duck, and we were back here in the body of the Duck.
A mortar round killed Angelo's lieutenant and the Duck's driver.
They were killed instantly. I remember, you know, you don't forget something like that.
And you're on Omaha Beach.
Yeah.
The bloodiest
dog
beach
red. Yeah.
Could you see anybody else from the 116th on the beach?
Yeah, well, yeah. Some of them were wounded, some were dead already. And you were just trying to save yourself.
So he lets the ramp down, so we go down. Of course, naturally on the other side of the sandbar, you go down to the water, and it was clear up to my top of my head almost.
I said, "Come on, fellas, let's go." And we just ran, and everybody went helter-skelter. You know, there was no... There was no plan.
There was a beach master up there directing the traffic, and I don't know how he survived. He said, "Go straight ahead, follow that path, otherwise you'll be in minefield." So we did, and there were bodies to right and left.
When you get ashore, you suffer 4 casualties, 1 killed, 3 wounded from mines.
And I said, "Step in my footsteps as I go up." And then I hear this loud explosion in back of me, and one guy didn't get the word, killed himself and a man next to him, and wounded 2 others.
A little further east at Point de Hoc, Len Lamel and the 2nd Rangers had to use grappling hooks to scale the face of the sheer stone cliffs.
As our ramps went down, I was the first one shot through the right side. I went off the ramp anyway and disappeared from sight. And the guys got me up and pulled me on. And we rushed to the bottom of the cliffs, grabbed a rope, and went up the rope. And while the Germans cut the ropes, dropped grenades on us, and shot us off the ropes.
Their mission was to knock out a battery of German 88-millimeter artillery pieces at the top, some 10 stories up.
The paramount thing, the most important thing, is find those guns and destroy them so they can't kill thousands of men on Omaha Beach and thousands of men on Utah Beach.
Despite his wounds, Len made it to the top. But the German guns were nowhere to be found.
The Germans stuck telephone poles to make it look from the sky in the aerial photographs that they were still there.
Now they'd have to go on the hunt for them. But the cost in lives of his Rangers had already been high.
I landed with 22 guys. I started up to the cliffs, and I lost half of them.
3 hours after the landings, the Allies told the world of the invasion.
Allied naval forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
The landings at Utah and the British beaches were going well, but the Americans in Omaha were being cut to ribbons, and success there was by no means assured.
Eisenhower had scribbled this little message that said, "Our landings on the shores of Normandy have failed. And although we had done everything that we possibly could, the responsibility for this failure is mine and mine alone."
Eisenhower wrote that note before the invasion and hoped he'd never have to use it. Next, the GIs make it to the top of those bluffs over Omaha and find the going no easier as they move inland. Stay with us.
It was the middle of the night back home when word of the invasion was first broadcast on radio. But as Americans awoke, the news electrified the nation.
What was remarkable was how many people went to church just simply to thank God, to pray, and pray for the safety of these men, many of whom they knew were going to die.
By 10 a.m., H hour plus 3.5, the U.S. 4th Infantry Division had been on the move inland for over 2 hours, leaving Utah Beach behind them. A few miles away, paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne had begun to take the roads and bridges those troops would need.
This roadway and this bridge had to be secured, and my company, A Company, 505 Parachute Infantry, was to sit on the bridge.
Murphy's unit waged a fierce firefight with the Germans for a small but important bridge.
The significance was that this little bridge was the only way to get across to the west.
With the help of a local Frenchman, another battalion had waged a fierce fight for the nearby town of St. Mary Glees.
They were led by this fellow who had a little bit in excess of wine, but he led Colonel Krause into St. Mary Glees, probably the first town liberated and occupied Europe by my regiment.
When they saw the American soldier there, they went out of their way to help, even though a lot of them may have been in jeopardy.
Many of them paid with their lives. Others were tortured by the Gestapo and sent to prison camps.
In fact, before the invasion, the French underground discovered that the Germans had already removed their artillery pieces from Pointe du Hoc.
The French underground tried to get this information to the Allied High Command. They never did.
Len Lamel had found out the hard way and had taken his platoon behind enemy lines to hunt for the deadly weapons.
So then Jack Kuhn, Sergeant Kuhn, he and I went down this sunken road. We saw tracks on the road.
Less than a mile inland, he found five of the fearsome guns.
And we just happened to sneak up on them and found them there. And they had about 75 or 100 Germans, 75 or 100 feet away from us.
With a bullet wound in his side, he slipped silently up to the guns with two thermite grenades that would melt metal into their working parts and destroy them.
Jack had one, he gave me his, and I had one that took out two of them, and I knocked all the sights.
But there were still three guns left, so they had to sneak back through the enemy lines to get more grenades.
We quickly stuffed a lot of grenades in our jackets that the guys gave us and ran back and used the rest of them on the remaining guns.
The artillery the Allied commanders feared most was done for, and Lamel would earn the Distinguished Service Cross for his bravery. By 10 a.m., only a few determined men had reached the top of the bluffs at Omaha Beach.
How long were you pinned down on the beach?
4 or 5 hours, I guess.
And right here against these dunes, a deadly German crossfire cut men and machines to pieces.
Until those four destroyers come in and fired at that low level underneath those gun placements into those ravines and knocked out those machine guns and those mortars.
The Navy ships almost ran aground, and they were so close they could actually spot the German soldiers.
Fortunately, they were there because without the Navy hitting that cliff, we would have made it.
That opened it up so that the engineers could open the path and get off the beach. So we were working with the tide against the clock to blow this 50-yard path through those mined obstacles. And of course, we were all being shot to hell and gone and lost our ammunition.
On shore, Army combat engineers blew barbed wire defenses using Bangalore torpedoes, pipes filled with TNT. Walt Ehler's platoon was helped by two of these men while under fire from above.
I told them we'll fire up into the trenches while they put the Bangalore torpedo in the wire and blow it. And they did. One guy did get killed. The other one got it blown for us. We went through up into the trenches.
Amazingly, it was mid-morning before Field Marshal Erwin Rommel was even informed of the attack on Normandy and abruptly ended his visit to his wife in Germany. Hitler wasn't told until even later.
It just seems incredible that the Allies mount an invasion of France and Hitler's military advisors and chiefs were afraid to awaken him. He was asleep. He didn't arise on D-Day till somewhere close to noon.
It was 4 p.m. before Hitler released 2 divisions of armor from reserve to battle the Allies. Only he could order their movement.
He never trusted his military commanders, and in particular, it was crucial in the Normandy campaign and on D-Day. So the Germans lost a lot, but the main thing that the Germans lost was time. Time is what they didn't have. They had to counterattack almost immediately, and this just simply didn't happen.
Next, hand-to-hand combat and the amazing act of courage that earns Walt Ehlers the Medal of Honor. Stay tuned to War Stories.
We had no idea that the 4th Division and all of the infantry and tanks had landed in our support.
By early afternoon on D-Day, the forces that had come across Utah Beach and the airborne began linking up inland. And at Omaha, the first tanks were advancing off the beach by 4 p.m. The Navy ships then shifted their fire miles inland to support the advance.
The guns of the naval ships were critical, not only to the success of D-Day, but to the success of the Normandy campaign.
As the Allies moved forward, German prisoners were sent back for evacuation to England by ship. Wounded Allied soldiers took the same route.
We could try to stop the bleeding and get them transportable. That's about all you could do.
And what do we hit next? The hedgerow country of France. I'm not talking about the hedgerow in your front yard. I'm talking about a wall that was built over the centuries.
And these hedgerows are very close-knit bushes, probably 6 feet tall.
That became a major obstacle to forward progress of the 29th Division.
Getting through a hedgerow usually meant shedding blood because the enemy lurked behind almost everyone. It was in this fighting that Walt Ehlers earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor.
I was leading my squad from one hedgerow over across to the next one.
Enemy fire erupted.
I went down the hedgerow from where the firing was coming from.
Braving a hail of bullets, Walt knocked out a machine gun position manned by 4 Germans, then advanced to a mortar section manned by 10 more, wiped it out, then did the same with a second machine gun emplacement.
The guys gave me credit for killing 17 or 18 Germans that day.
Ordered to withdraw, Walt covered his men.
When I was firing like this around the hedgerow, and I was standing there knocking out the 3 guys who were putting in that machine gun, and I got hit in the side, and they turned me around, and as I'm falling, I had my rifle at port arms, so I saw a German up the hedgerow, and I shot him, and he fell out of the hedgerow.
His automatic rifleman was also hit.
So I went up and got him, and put his arm around, and I carried him to partly, you know, back. He was kind of like dragging him along, and got him back to the hedgerow, and then I thought, well, gee whiz, we got to have that rifle. So I went back and got the rifle, still under fire.
You'd already been wounded.
Yeah, this bullet went here, hit the rib, and went out. It went in and out, into the pack, hit the bar of soap, and it went through the back of my pack and through my mother's picture.
Your mom had given you this picture before you left?
Yeah, I always carried it with me.
Though severely wounded, Walt refused to be evacuated and stayed with his unit. A few weeks later, Walt discovered the worst about his brother Roland.
The company commander brought the work. He was the one that brought me the message that my brother was killed on D-Day. He was a great soldier. He was my hero, actually. He was a fantastic person.
Out comes the white flag of surrender. More prisoners taken in the drive to the important city of San Lo. the capture of which opens the way for the great advance that has crashed through for long miles.
It was not until the end of July that we were able to finally get a breakthrough on the western side of Normandy. And this breakthrough led to the virtual collapse of the German front.
The world would soon discover the true horror of the Holocaust when German concentration camps were found. Al Ungerleiter, who's Jewish, led the liberation of one camp near Nordhausen.
The sight so appalled my eyes that I still have nightmares about it.
You did not know that these guys were running these kinds of camps back there.
Right. The sight of those people lying on beds with sores covering all parts of their body, just moaning and groaning. And that's when it hit me, really hit me, of what the Germans were doing to people.
By nightfall on D-Day, the Allies had landed over 150,000 troops on the five invasion beaches. There were 5,000 casualties, but they'd opened a big crack in Hitler's Atlantic Wall, and through it, hundreds of thousands more men and machines would pour in the weeks ahead.
It would take another year and thousands more young lives to defeat the Nazis, a tribute to these fallen heroes when War Stories continues.
Don't honor us. You honor the ones that didn't make it. They're the ones that made the supreme sacrifice. They didn't come back. They're still there. I'm here.
When Rick Lazio awarded us the Medal of Honor from the French government, I said to him, I'm only accepting this in memory of the kids that didn't make it. I said, they were the guys that deserved it. Because he never had a chance to come back and enjoy this country.
I have other friends that I visit at the San Loren Cemetery at Omaha Beach. We have many officers and men that are buried there. If you see the men in these American cemeteries, whether it be France or Holland or Belgium, you can find out and get the message that freedom is not free. You must pay for it, sometimes with your life.
Almost 9,400 Americans rest in this cemetery at Omaha. All of them knew that victory could cost them their lives. Honoring them, General Eisenhower said, "To these we owe the high resolve that the cause for which they died shall live." Those words are inscribed in this memorial, a vivid reminder of the price of freedom. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.